making all this possible. And sorry, top of my head is knocked up on the video, huh? That's not such a bad idea necessarily. Okay. I also want to thank Reem once again for all the technical arrangements. I'll ask people if they could please turn their cell phones to silent or vibrate or something. That would be helpful. And there are two sign-in sheets around. One started over there, one started over there. Please make sure that you sign in. If you signed in last week and you wrote your email address last week, there's no need to write it again. Just sign in without the email address. But it's important so that I can follow up on questions and issues that come up during the class. I'll also be able to send out the link for the audio recording once that is online. Topic for today is ramifications of a bounced check. And this is one of those cases in which I actually came up with the topic and advertised the topic because I wanted to learn about it, so I didn't know what I was going to find when I actually started researching it. And what I found really surprised me. And we'll see what I'm talking about, what the surprises are as we go along. But there's some very interesting material on this. Clearly and obviously, one is not allowed to write a bad check knowingly, both from a Jewish law perspective and from a Canadian law perspective. If you're interested in the Canadian Criminal Code, it's paragraphs 361, 362, false pretenses. But what I want to address are three principal questions regarding cases in which a check is unintentionally bounced. The first is, how is a check viewed in Jewish law in terms of the writer's obligation to the bearer if it does bounce? And one of the cases we'll see is the following case. Let's say I know someone who's getting married, and I decide I'm going to write them a check. I'm going to give them a gift. And I give them a check for whatever sum of money you want. And then the check bounces. Do I have any further obligation to them for the fact that the check bounced? Do I owe them the gift that was specified in the check? That's question number one. Question number two is, let's say, for whatever purpose, gift, purchase, whatever, you give someone a check, and the check bounces, and as a result, the person who attempted to deposit it has to pay a fee. Am I, as the writer of the check, responsible to reimburse them for the fee that they ended up paying? And then the third question, if I were to use a check to purchase something and the check were to bounce, would that be grounds for the seller canceling the sale? Would the merchant be able to say, I'm not interested in selling this to you, the sale is now void? And there are serious ramifications for that in Jewish law that we'll discuss. So these are the three issues that I'd like to address. Now, one of the problems you run into when you want to deal with the question of checks is, of course, that checks are a relatively new phenomenon in financial history. They're possibly on their way out with the so much of what we do is digital. But nonetheless, checks begin, according to the resources that I checked out, which is not only Wikipedia, checks begin in early 16th century Holland, it seems, as things go, and they evolve over time. So what are you going to do when so much of Jewish law actually predates early 16th century Holland? And so the answer is, you go looking for precedent, and you go looking for paradigms to see what the halachic view of a check actually is. So that's where we start, with the question of what is the appropriate model for a check in Jewish law. So there are three potential models that are suggested. The first potential model that's suggested is what's called in Hebrew a shtar chov. Shtar chov means, anybody know? A bill of debt. A bill of debt. A statement that I owe somebody money. An IOU is a shtar chov. It's a bill of debt. And one way to look at it is, when I write someone a check, I write a check for $100, so that check is a statement of, I owe that person $100. It doesn't say anything about any pre-existing debt. It's simply a statement that from this moment forward, there is a $100 debt that I owe to this person. And that's one way that it can be looked at. If you take a look on your sheets at the first source, this is from Rabbi Yaakov Yeshaya Blau, who passed away about a year and a half ago. He authored a magnificent 9-volume set, 10-volume set technically, called Pitchei Choshen on business ethics and business law. He was a dayan, a judge in Israel. And he writes, Das Rov HaPoskim, the view of most authorities is, Shebemakum sheyesh minag hamedina b'haknas shtar chov, that where there is some kind of established local practice regarding how debt is transferred, yeshli donoch b'yaminag, you go with whatever local custom is. And therefore he writes, v'lachein nera shebizmanenu nikne shtar chov b'hasava v'chein yeshli don b'shekim, or shekim, checks. He says, therefore, based on the fact that we follow local practice, so if somebody endorses a bill of debt, it is transferred to the recipient of that document. And he says, we're going to say the same thing regarding checks. That if somebody endorses a check, it is now owned by the recipient. But the key point that I wanted to draw from this line is that he equates bills of debt with checks. This is one way to write the word check in Hebrew, in case anyone is interested. Shin Yud Kuf. The technical Hebrew term is actually Hamcha'a. But everybody writes some version of this. Either they write Shin Yud Kuf, or Shin, and then quotation marks Kuf, or sometimes Tzadi with a Chukchik Kuf, or some version of that. For those who are more Yiddish in their thinking and in their spelling, they'll do Tet Shin Ayin Kuf. Some version of the word check. You'll see that. We'll get to that. But that's his position, is that you could say a check is a statement of I owe the bearer of this document X amount. If you take a look at source number 2, he expands on it. He says, Yesh limtzot tzadei zechut v'kinyan sheyesh lemekabel ha-check miyad mitzad minag ha-medina. He says, you could determine elements of acquisition and transaction for the recipient of the check based on whatever local practice is. Whatever rules we're going to provide for how the check functions are going to conform with local practice. Shalpi minag hamedina, based on local practice, hamachzik b'check dino kemachzik b'shtar chov. Based on local practice, the holder of a check is the equivalent of the holder of a bill of debt. In parentheses, he does note that technically it's only evidence of debt, but that's good enough. V'nimtza ki'ilu ischayev kosev ha-check l'shalem l'mutav ha-schum ha-nikanakuv b'check. He says it's as though the issuer of the check has said, I agree that I owe this amount to the bearer, u'meila yesh lidon bo k'din shtar chov, and so you should view it as you view a bill of debt. That's one way to look at it. A second way to look at it is that it's stronger than a bill of debt. It's actually what we call shvei kesef, the equivalent of money. And the reason for this is because it has a superpower to it, a check. If there's a bill of debt, a standard bill of debt will say, so-and-so owes money to somebody else, and it will name both parties. What power does a check have over that? How is a check more powerful than that?
Payable to bearer.
Payable to bearer. Exactly. The check could be payable to whoever happens to be holding on to this document, and even if it doesn't say payable to bearer, it can be endorsed over to somebody else. All you need is a signature on it. And this actually has precedent in a document which is referred to sometimes as a Mamremi or Mamreni document. That's referred to hundreds of years ago in Jewish law. That word is not a Jewish word. It's not a Hebrew word. It comes from some other European language. I'm not sure even what language it's coming from. I looked around a little bit. Couldn't find it. But the point is that if a document records that a sum of money is claimable by the bearer, then it's indistinguishable, really, from general money. Right? Once you say to somebody that the holder of this document can walk into any bank and get money for it, even if he's not named in it, what's the difference between that and a dollar bill? There are certain differences, because he couldn't necessarily use it in any business, right? You can't walk into just any business and hand over the check. They have to be businesses that will take checks. So it's not a dollar bill. However, it it's fairly close. And so the second argument is that it's actually a monetary equivalent. And Rabbi Blau records this in source number 3, where he writes, "V'nira she'check al atzmo chashuv kikesef v'adif mishtar." He says one's own check, a check drawn on one's own funds, would be like money. It's stronger than a document, stronger than a bill of debt. "U'b'chekim shel acherim nira gam kein da'adif mishtar chov al acherim." And if you're holding a check written by somebody else, it's going to be stronger than a bill of debt that you have, recording someone else's debt to you. "D'chekim bizmanenu chashivi kishtar mamreini shedino kekesef." He says checks today would be considered like that mamreini document I mentioned that they used to have, which said on it, whoever is holding this gets money from my account. That's the argument that he brings. "V'al kol panim shvei kesefu." It is at least considered to be the equivalent of money. That's the statement that he makes. Now, he does have a caveat. He continues to say, hang on, just a second. In source number 3, he continues to say, "V'nira she'ein dino shel check kekesef, ela kishnichtav v'husav al pi kol na'alei abankim." He says it has to be written and endorsed according to all the rules of the banks. Even if you'll say there's a particular rule that is on the books but nobody enforces it, in order for this to be considered a monetary equivalent, it has to be without challenge, something that everybody would have to accept, and therefore it has to be written according to all of the rules. And so that's the second argument. Yes?
It used to say on our currency, "We'll pay to the bearer on the man for a dollar."
Right.
So it's the same, because the government, the Bank of Canada, is giving you the equivalent of check.
Right.
What you mentioned before about it, not, there are some places that won't take money, they'll only take credit card or checks.
Are you?
Yeah.
Really? Interesting. That I wasn't familiar with. Places that don't take cash but will take checks.
Security problem, cash.
Okay, I hear that. Dory.
So, source number 3 also refers to you can only claim what's in the bank account. You can't go out to the person's personal assets.
Right, so that's where this is going to be a big deal. In other words, right now I'm just laying out different models, but there are going to be practical applications of choosing a particular model. So when we get there, we have to talk about that more. But before we get there, I want to point out a third possible model, and then we're going to collect all our models and see, so what do you do with this? The first model is that it's the equivalent of a bill of debt. The second model is that it's actually the equivalent of money itself. And then the third model is that it's actually shlichus, or agency. And the idea is that when I write somebody a check, what I'm really doing is giving them a set of instructions to pass along to my bank. The instructions say to the bank, when someone gives you this, give them money from my account. You, the bank, are my shaliach. The bank is my agent to transfer those funds. So those are my three possible models with huge ramifications as to which one you're going to choose. I'll give you just an easy ramification before we get into some of the more complicated ones. In order to get married, right, a man gives a woman traditionally a ring. Right? That's kiddushin. A man has to give a woman something of value. He can give her kesef money, or he can give her shvei kesef, the monetary equivalent. If I take the view that a check counts as shvei kesef, as a monetary equivalent, he can give her a check under the chuppah. Now, mind you, that's a little unromantic. And it raises all sorts of questions if the check bounces. Sorry? Tax implications, oh boy. But calling something shvei kesef, a monetary equivalent, is a very serious thing. Which model do you think really reflects the nature of a check? Knowing what we do about our banking system, what would you say is the compelling explanation of what a check is? Is it a bill of debt? The writer is saying, I owe you the money. Is it a monetary equivalent? It's just like money. It's just not minted cash, but it's like money. Or do I say that it's agency? It's a document that says to the bank, be my agent to give so-and-so from my account. Could you pick one? And yeah.
I don't know if I could pick one or three, but it's hard to say that it's number 2, Kikesa, specifically because we've come up with humans like certified checks and bank drafts, which we use in most of our businesses, which specifically is to avoid the problem of a check not necessarily being Kikesa. And so we have certified checks, which, in all provenance and purposes,
So Yehuda points out a problem. In the event that you're going to call this a monetary equivalent, is it a monetary equivalent when you don't know for sure that the money is there to back it? Right? Money, by definition, has to be something that has value. This check may be worthless. It may be drawn on an account that's zero.
Money is what you're promised to pay by the government.
Right. But then it's not money. You know, from a halachic perspective.
Pay the money is not money?
So that's actually a good discussion in its own right. What is the status of a dollar bill? Or dollar coin, fine. But the right. But that's part of the question. And when you transfer systems, you go from fiat currency to, you know, documents that simply represent debt. In fact, the question is, how do we view cash? That's so we can have a discussion about cash too. But the point that I'm trying to make is, if a country's currency is devalued to the point where something is worthless, then indeed it is no longer money. And the argument would be, you can't call a check Shvei Kesef, the monetary equivalent, unless it actually is certified.
But the Shlichut argument, it's not the traditional way of thinking of Shlichut. I mean, in original Shlichut, you go to a person and tell them to do something.
Correct.
Here you're not going to the bank and telling the bank to do something. And the bank isn't a person, the bank is an entity. I don't know if Shlichut is this problem when you deal with a corporation. So you're giving it to someone else, and giving him authorization to get the money from your bank. So if it is a form of shlichut, it's kind of an indirect form of shlichut.
Correct. It is absolutely indirect. And a piece that I was going to include on here, but I decided not to, but maybe I should have, also from Rabbi Blau, is the same area as source number two. He discusses this and points out that you can appoint a shaliach, you can appoint an agent, by putting text in writing as well.
Right.
And he says that even if we will view the bank as a corporation that is not an individual, nonetheless, there is somebody who is charged with carrying this out, and that person would in the end be your shaliach. So he's aware of the question, but he says those can be addressed in the context of Jewish law. Jeff. And by the way, I have to thank Jeff for bringing flyers for another program and take a look at the flyers on your tables. Thank you, Jeff.
So it says on the check, typically paid to the order of. So it is, in fact, a direction, an authorization and a direction to the appropriate person in the bank. And the argument with regard to Shvei Kesef is, if it's done correctly, it should be the equivalent of money. The problem only arises when either there's not enough money to cover the check or it bounces, or the person to whom you've written the check doesn't have proper ID or is not able to. Under all other circumstances, though, it should be the equivalent of money. And the argument about maybe money doesn't have the equivalency of money is, again, the counterfeit argument. If someone gives you a $100 bill and it's counterfeit, they could equally well give you a check for $100, which may or may not pass muster, but it also has the equivalent of money.
Right. Or neither of those have the equivalent
or
of money.
Neither.
Yeah.
In the case of the shlichut, in this case, isn't the bank making you a shliach?
In what way?
The check and the ability to write the check. The bank is making you a shliach.
Well,
or they're,
the bank is making the opportunity available for me. But they're not a shliach means they've actually assigned me a task. Do this.
Well, they give you a check,
and I can choose not to write any checks at all. I could burn them. They've made it available for me. Yes, I can effectively appoint somebody to do a task for me. Keep in mind, the shaliach is the bank, so it's whoever's working in the bank, however you want to call it. But I am able to assign it to whoever ends up being the recipient of this document. That actually does work, as odd as it sounds. Take a look at number four, please. This is from the Bills of Exchange Act. A bill of exchange, and that includes checks, is an unconditional order in writing addressed by one person to another, signed by the person giving it, requiring the person to whom it is addressed to pay, on demand or at a fixed or determinable future time, a sum certain in money to or to the order of a specified person or to bearer. That actually made a lot more sense when I read it the other day. Reading it aloud changes it. But what it seems to me, if I read this, is that this sounds most like shlichut, like agency, right? It's an order in writing addressed to somebody saying, I want you to pay a certain amount to so-and-so. It is not an acceptance by the writer of, I owe somebody money. It's a statement of, I want so-and-so to pay another person. That's the way it looks to me. We're going to find out as we go along that it's not so clear. That, in fact, the Bills of Exchange Act seems to contradict itself. And I consulted, actually, with a couple of lawyers the other day about this, and none of them had read the Bills of Exchange Act. Although they deal in lending. But we'll see. I think there seems to be some kind of a hybrid paradigm within the Act. Another practical application, besides the marriage application, the practical application of this question of how I view checks, when is the right to the money acquired? If I take the model that this is a shtar chov, that it's a bill of debt, right? So I hand somebody a check, and I say, here, this is a check for $100. At what point in time do I owe that person $100?
Well, you're supposed to date the check. It could be post-dated.
Let's say the date's today. If I take the bill of debt argument, I owe now. As soon as I hand him a document that says that here's a check for $100, I owe him $100. On the other hand, if I take the eight, and certainly if it's Shemay Kesef, if it's a monetary equivalent, assuming that it's, well, actually, let me take that back. The Shemay Kesef, not necessarily. Because if, in fact, there is no money behind it, it's like your counterfeit dollar bill. It was nothing. It wasn't Shemay Kesef at all. But if it's a valid check, then right now, I owe him that. It is money. If I were to burn that check, I would have to give him $100 in exchange for it. If I take the agency argument, then when is it that he acquires my $100?
When the agent is performed.
When the agent gives him the $100. All I gave him right now was an order to the bank of give him $100. And in the event that the bank doesn't carry it out, he didn't acquire it. That's the way it goes. Larry.
Aren't you saying two different things? The first thing you said was that when is the debt established? And the second one is when is the payment to take place? Usually I would think that a check is not the initial acknowledgement of a debt. Mm-hmm. It's the next stage in the settlement, the first stage in the settlement of the debt. But the check would usually follow a debt that was established before, either the delivery of goods under an invoice or another deed of debt.
Right. So what about where there wasn't any? I'm giving it as a gift. When did the debt originate?
The debt never existed.
Right, except that we're talking about the possibility that you're writing the check actually creates it. It's not a debt in the sense of someone provided something for me and now I am repaying them. It's a debt in the same sense that I am fully able, within Jewish law and secular law, to create an artificial debt. If I write a document that says I owe somebody money, no one has to ask me, why do you owe him that? From this moment forward, there's a debt. So that would be the argument for the check, is that the moment I write a check and sign my name that says that so-and-so should get $100 out of my account, there is money that now is in his name that's sitting in my account. That would be the argument.
So it's later.
But it's now. It's right now. Oh, and you said neder.
Yeah.
I thought you said later. So actually, there is such an argument that writing the check constitutes a vow of sorts, at least in cases where it's tzedakah. Where if I were to write a check for a charity, and then it were to bounce, I would be required to fulfill my original pledge, which I created by writing the check, because that in and of itself counts as a neder, that counts as a vow. There is indeed an argument for that. See, if you take a look at source number... Did I bring it here? Yeah, number six, sorry. Number five was just the argument that it could be viewed as a form of agency. Meant to include that before number four. Okay. Take a look at number six now, please. Right, Menachem Mendel Krachmal, author of Tzemach Tzedek. There are two Tzemach Tzedeks. This is the earlier Tzemach Tzedek. The later Tzemach Tzedek was the second Lubavitcher Rebbe. But this is Rabbi Menachem Mendel Krachmal, and he writes of the following case. Reuven Hilva LeShimon Bishtar Mechasimas Yodo. Reuven lent money to Shimon with a document under his own signature, kasher noagin ha'idna, as is done today, mashakorin mamrimi, he calls it a mamrimi, v'hainu, shehilva chosam chasim, shalove chosim chasimas yado be'emtza ha'megillah, the way it was done was, the lender would sign his name in the middle of the page. The kosev me'aver ladaf, and then he would write on the other side, gam came bam to the megilta, also in the middle of it, right opposite his signature, mechuvah neged hachasima, b'zeh alashon, he would write the following, mashmos shtar zeh ala chosum me'aver ladaf, the meaning of, or the intent of this document of debt, upon the person who is signed on the other side of the page, misach mea zehuvim zman peraon l'rosh chodesh nisan shin tzadi tet lamed, with the amount being of 100 gold coins that have to be paid, and the date for it is rosh chodesh nisan, the year 5429. That's the document that he's dealing with. V'yesh l'shtar chasimas yado zek kol tokef shtar shaba olam, and he says such a document has the force of any document in the world. V'eino yachol liton parati, and he can't say I already paid this, meaning that if the document surfaces and someone wants to claim it, he can't say, well, I already paid this, not unless there's some kind of receipt on the document itself, you know, something saying canceled, paid, whatever it is. Otherwise, too bad. Anybody who finds it can claim it. And that is the practice of local merchants. This is what they do. So the model of the Tzemach Tzedek is that this is indeed a full-blown shtar chov. It is a full-blown bill of debt. And therefore it is owed from the time that he actually... It is owed from the time that he issues this document. Not everybody agrees. In source number 7, Rabbi Avram David Horovitz argues in response that Tzemach Tzedek's case was where there actually was a debt. And this was meant to be payment of a debt. It was a borrower who was repaying a lender. He says it's not so clear that this will always be true. But if I were to take the Mamreni or Mamreni model, then I would say, once you write the check, the money is owed. In the event that I were to take the Shvei Kesef model, that it's a monetary equivalent, then it's immediate. As soon as you hand over the document, it's owed. If I take the agency model, it's not owed until the bank acts as your agent. So that will be one practical application. Second practical application, can you cancel your check before it is deposited? If you take the view that it's a Mamreni model or a Shvei Kesef model, right, either that it's a bill of debt or that it is a monetary equivalent, can't cancel it. Right? It's too late. The other guy's got it already. However, if I take the view that it's agency, you can cancel the agency anytime. The fact that I send someone to the bank to tell the bank to give him money doesn't preclude me from, in advance, saying, you know what, I don't want the bank to do that, and from canceling the check. It may be wrong to cancel. And in the case that Bob mentioned before, that we talked about a tzedakah case, it would be violation potentially of one's vow. It shows bad faith, but it can be done. And then the third practical application is the question of giving it to someone as a gift, the case I mentioned before. I gave the person who's getting married a check for $100. The check then bounced. Do I owe him $100? What do you say? Yes. Yes? Why? Which model are you taking for what checks are? That's what's going to determine it, right? In the event that I view it as a bill of debt, in the event that I view it as a monetary equivalent, then yeah, I owe him $100 now. If I view it as agency, then I do not owe him $100. It's all in how you view the model. Well, what's particularly interesting about this is Canada's Bills of Exchange Act. If you take a look at source number 8, and I couldn't believe it when I read it, and I sent it to Steve, and I sent it to maybe two or three other, lawyers and accountants, and said, does this mean what I think it means? And yeah, it does. Where a bill is dishonored, the measure of damages which shall be deemed to be liquidated damages are, the first item is, the amount of the bill. Indeed, you owe the guy $100. Even though it was a gift. Doesn't make a difference. The money is indeed owed. And this goes back to my point about the Bills of Exchange Act apparently contradicting itself. Because on the one hand, it views this check, as we saw on the first side, as agency. right? It views it as this person just being your agent to bring it to the bank. If he's only my agent to bring it to the bank, if the check bounces, there's nothing further to discuss. Nonetheless, it says, no, if the check bounces, you owe him the money. So it's presenting two different models. I suspect the reason why they do this is simply because of concern for bad faith in people's dealings. Even though it doesn't fit the logical model for the check, you don't want a situation in which people feel free to give people, to give others bad checks, right? If you're telling me there's no responsibility for the sum, that adds an incentive for people to write bad checks. So maybe that's the justification. But but it's actually apparently contradictory. What would we say within Jewish law? Surprise, it's a debate. Rabbi Avraham David Horovitz, who I mentioned in source number 7, in his Kinyan Torah, argues that a check is like agency, and therefore there's no liability for the gift. The Pitchei Choshen, Rabbi Blau, seems to be less sure of that. He really wants to argue that it's a bill of debt and possibly even Shvei Kesef, monetary equivalent. But in the end, he backs down. And he says, since we're not sure, you don't owe the money. So the upshot is, from a Jewish law perspective, and this is what really surprised me as I was preparing this, from a Jewish law perspective, you do not owe the gift. However, from a Canadian law perspective, you do.
Therefore, from a Jewish point of view, you do as well.
Law of the land is the law.
Law of the land.
Correct. Correct. This is a case where you would follow local practice, and therefore you would indeed be required to pay. Now, it's funny, when I was researching this, I also did a little bit of digging in general on what was being said about these things, and I came across a whole bunch of sort of etiquette and protocol websites where people asked, I got married and somebody gave me a check and it bounced. What do you recommend I do? Dear Abby type of questions. How do you expect I handle this? And the answer tended to be, well, that if their check bounced, they received a notification from their bank, and therefore they know already. So you're better off not saying anything. Either they're going to give you a gift, in which case you'll write them a nice thank you note, right? Or just leave it be. That was their advice, which, yeah, I think is sound advice. Yehuda.
Can you just clarify how these two articles from the Bill of Exchange Act, how you see them as touching each other? I see the first one we read as saying requiring someone to pay doesn't sound much like
because, right, I hear your question, but looking back at the first quote from the Bills of Exchange Act in Source 4, it's an order addressed to the bank saying, please take money from my account and give it to so-and-so. In the event that there's no money in my account, so there's nothing for them to do. I haven't created any obligation for myself. I just told somebody to do this. In the event that I sent somebody to my house and I said, do me a favor, please, I want you to wash the windows on the third floor. Comes to my house and sees there is no third floor. So, all right, it's over. There's nothing further, there's no further, result.
I read it as well that there's not much of a contradiction. The second part of it is saying that you have by writing that check. The fact that you had no money in your account made it impossible for the agent to carry out their mandate. And from the bank standpoint, there's a credibility issue that if in fact you are going to sign a check on our stationery, to speak, you have, by law, obligated yourself to fulfill it.
Where do you see him obligating himself in there?
Which part?
In source number 4.
Number 4?
Yeah, where do you see him obligating himself? The requiring the person line refers to the bank, not the writer.
Yeah. The bank, that you are authorizing the bank to pay...
Yeah, I'm authorizing the bank to pay a sum. That may not exist. Where do you see me obligating myself as the writer of the check? I'm talking about from there.
If you were not a customer of the bank, which already gives you status, you would have no ability to authorize the bank to carry.
Absolutely true. But where have I obligated myself to pay a certain sum?
Right, there's this unconditional order in writing.
Yeah, but it still doesn't mean that I obligated myself in anything. That just means I told them unconditionally, go ahead and do this. Right, but it's still not an obligation.
Right.
Yeah. They're acquiring the waters, but there's, you know, there's another issue with checks. With those exchanges, which is a matter of negotiability.
Yes.
In other words, once I sign the check to you, you can then endorse it and give it to a third party who then assumes that it's okay. So once it's, so by signing a check, it's out in the world, and I would imagine then it's closest to the argument that it's Shabbat Kesef.
Yes, and that is indeed. The fact that it can be endorsed to anybody is one of the arguments in favor of associating it with the Mamre'imi document, because it really could end up with anybody. Yes?
Yeah, and in support of what this gentleman just said, when he says places signing the check, signing is accepted as a self-fulfilled commitment.
That's not in the wording. That's what we add to it. The wording doesn't say so.
Yeah, but the fact is, using the word signing, shows that he is taking upon himself, yes, I am really going to do that. When you say that the signature acts as a neder in this particular context,
I'll tell you what, I'm going to, only in the Tzedakah case, because in Tzedakah cases the restrictions on your speech and your commitments are stronger than in other cases. I can come back to this at the end if people want. There's more to see, and I'll be glad to discuss at the end. If you take a look at our second issue, is, as I mentioned at the outset, if the check bounces, is the writer obligated to reimburse the bearer for his fees? And the answer to this goes back to a discussion we had, I think, last year. It was last year or 2 years ago, when we had a session on professional malpractice. And we talked about what's called garmi. The general rule is that a Jew who does something that causes somebody else to lose money, but only indirectly, is not going to be liable in a rabbinical court, in a Beit Din, as long as it's indirect. If I directly harm somebody's property, that's a different story. If it's indirect, it's called grama. However, if it's somewhere in between direct and indirect, it may enter the category called garmi, for which you may be liable. So, for example, we dealt with a case in which a woman had a coin that someone had offered her. They wanted to buy something from her. They offered her the coin. She brought it to a money changer who's supposed to be an expert in valid coins. The money changer says, yes, this is a valid coin. She accepts it on his say-so, sells whatever merchandise it was, and then tries to use the coin and finds out that, in fact, it's not accepted. So there, he gave professional advice, and it was wrong, and he could be liable. Again, that depends on the whole discussion about malpractice, but he could be liable under the laws of garmi. So the question is, in our case, the person gave me a check, which I tried to deposit, and it bounced, costing me whatever the check fee is, $15, $25, whatever it is that garmi? Did they indirectly cause me harm? It wasn't direct. They didn't go into my bank account and take $25. But on the other hand, they had to know this was going to be the result. And even if they didn't know, it is the result of their action. So we have to look back at two paradigms. Take a look, please, at source number 9. One form. A case involving seeds. You have a person who is selling gardening seeds, and these are seeds that are inedible, as I added in brackets. These are seeds that are not for food. So a person sells somebody seeds, and they don't grow. And we are assuming here, a major assumption, that you're able to determine that the reason they didn't grow was because of the seeds. It wasn't about the dirt, it wasn't about external circumstances, it was because the seeds were defective. How you know it, doesn't matter. Mao no sing lo. So what is he obligated to give to the farmer who bought the seeds? Deme zera velo hotza. The first view is only to refund the value of the seeds. All the money that the farmer invested in plowing, hiring workers, whatever it is, no. Just the value of the seeds themselves. One view. Second view, yesh omrim av hotza. The second view says no. The expense of planting also. Whose view is that? That's the view of Rabban Shimon ben Gamliel, who taught a separate case. I'm not going to go into it now in the interest of time, but you can see it here in source number 9. The first model says, you are not obligated for side costs, only for the actual value of the seeds that you sold. Applying that to our case, you're not responsible for the fees. That would be one view. Second source, though. Take a look at source number 10, Rabbi Moses Maimonides. Writing regarding a happy couple who stopped being a happy couple in this particular case. He describes a practice that they used to have in which a man and woman would get engaged and then the man would make a big feast. So in his case, a couple gets engaged. The man goes out to spend money on the feast, hires the people, buys the food, and then she says, you know what, not interested. He's now spent all this money. So take a look at what Rambam says. Ho Rabosai, my masters have ruled. Shemhaya minag hamedina shayasa kol adam su'udav yachil l'rayav. If local practice is that when a man gets engaged, he makes a feast, he feeds everybody, o yechalek ma'os l'shamashin l'chazanin, or alternatively, the practice is that he pays various people in celebration. V'asa kiderach sha'os in kolam, and this fellow does exactly what normal people do. V'chazer ba'in, she backs out. Mishalem es hakol. She has to pay him for his expenses. Even though, again, it's indirect, right? She intended at the time of the engagement, she was not expecting to back out, there's no dishonesty here, but she has to pay. Why? Sherei garma lo la'abei mamon. She caused him to lose money. And if you cause someone to lose money, you have to pay. And then he has a whole discussion about whether you have to present receipts or and so on. But the question is, which is the paradigm for the check? Is it like the seeds, or is it like the meal? What would you say?
Like the meal.
Why?
Well, it's very accepted. It's very known that there are these costs of people that we know. It's very directly related. I think that the extra cost on the seed is being just a little bit more removed in terms of the impact. You know, you buy the seed, you don't know really what the farmer's going to have a lot of expenses. He may work himself, he may just plan to do nothing, so it's not quite as connected. Whereas, you know, you pretty much know in the wedding case that you'll have that the party that has to cost money, and you also have to know even more so that there's a fee involved with the son of the check.
Right. Okay, so that's certainly one argument. It's more direct here, and therefore it's more like the wedding meal. Okay, let's take a look and see. The various sages tried to explain the difference between the seeds case and the marriage case, because we have a problem. The Shulchan Aruch, the Code of Jewish Law, follows both of these sources. Meaning, it rules that in the seeds case, you don't have to pay the expenses, and it rules that in the wedding case, the engagement meal case, you do have to pay for the meal. So the question is, what is the difference between the two? Three suggestions out of several that are suggested. One view, source number 11, a standard commentator to Rambam, to Maimonides, Rabbi Vidal of Toulouse, also known as Magid Mishnah, he takes the view that the reason why you don't pay for the seeds is because you don't pay for the planting, I should say, is because that's an act the farmer embarked on for profit. It's really an independent action. As opposed to the meal, which isn't for profit. That's what you do when you get engaged. This is what you do. That's a very difficult argument that he makes. And some other commentators look at it and say, I don't understand the logic. It may be true, but so what?
The reverse should be true.
Yeah.
Relying for his livelihood, he's lost livelihood. Maybe he's going to lose his farm or his house. He should be compensated for the extra loss. But the engagement, arguably, is discretionary. You didn't need to make such a big party. Never mind that maybe
it's not discretionary though. This is what everybody does. It's considered, this is the norm. This is what you do. It's like you have to go buy a blue suit for your bar mitzvah. It's just what's happening.
I think what he's saying, is the profit. The profit is when you go to do things to make a profit, you know you could lose money.
Yeah.
So he could have lost the money because of a storm.
Right.
Right? So his knowledge was, he said, I paid for the seed. Okay, if I didn't get the good seed, you have to replace that. But everything else he did, he basically understood was at risk.
Mm-hmm. Could be.
Then maybe it is going to be risk because of the seed, but he expected there to be risk. Whereas you don't expect to have that risk in the party.
Right. Could be. Bob, you're going to say, and then I'm going to go a little further with this.
Just quickly. So the seeds, though, is a effect of a market transaction. There's an agreement between a buyer and a seller, so there's a fixed mutual agreement on the price. The wedding is not. He could have bought more boots. He could have bought this silver. Two parties aren't in agreement for that transaction. It would be one-sided.
Right. So on that, Rambam stipulates. He says, "Va'asa kederach sha'osin kol ha'am," where he does as everyone does. In other words, there is the assumption that there is a norm, and he fit within that norm. If not, then you're right. There's no. She's not going to be liable for that if he chose to go above and beyond. But in terms of this explanation about profit, the way I look at it, and I'm not clear on it, and a lot of others are not clear on it, but the way I understand it is, it's almost as though he's saying it's a separate transaction when you choose to plant. Meaning, the seller's responsibility ended when he sold you the seeds. And therefore he has to pay you for the seeds. When you choose to go planting them, that's a new enterprise. And therefore the responsibility has ended. Maybe that's the logic. The other two arguments are easier, I find, to sustain. In source number 12, Rabbi Yoel Sirkis, in his Bach commentary to the Torah, just says, you don't know that the farmer actually wanted to plant with it. It's true that that's a logical assumption, but maybe it was for medicine. Who knows what it was really for? Yeah, Larry.
So this would be more like the concept of proximity, right? Which in professional liability, I mean, is it reasonable to assume that somebody's going to do something as a result of what you did?
Right.
So, was it reasonable for her to assume that he was going to make a party? Was it reasonable for the seller of the seeds to assume that somebody was going to plant?
Precisely. Yeah, that's the argument of Rabbi Yoel Sirkis. A third argument is from the Taz, Rabbi David Halevi, and he contends in source number 13 that the farmer who buys the seeds is buying them from somebody who's as in the dark as he is. You can't look at the seeds and know whether they're good or not good. So the merchant, at the time he sold them, thought he was selling him good seeds, and then didn't engage in any further act to harm the farmer after the sale. Whereas, in the case of the engagement, when she breaks the engagement, she knows exactly what this is going to cost him. And therefore, he argues, that's why there's liability. Applying these models to the bounced check, Rabbi Blau in his Pisrei Choshen says it's clear that the check writer is going to have to reimburse the bearer of the check for the bank fee. And even if it was entirely accidental. He says, if I take Magid Mishnah's view, that the distinction is it for profit or not, you don't deposit a check for profit. I mean, you were given a check, and now you're depositing it. It's not a new business enterprise. If you're going to take the argument that that Bach puts out, you didn't know, there was no, in the case of the seeds, you didn't have that proximity, you certainly do know that when you give someone a check, they're going to deposit it. That is the assumption. Whether it's them or whether they endorse it to somebody else, it's going to get deposited. So the argument that Pisrei Choshen makes is, and the Taz, by the way, may be a little bit different because he's dealing with who knew what and when they knew it. But the argument that Pisrei Choshen makes is that, indeed, the writer of the check is responsible to reimburse the person who deposited it for the fee. And whether that's the immediate person to whom they wrote it, or it was endorsed five times over, doesn't matter. Whoever deposits it is going to get that fee back. And indeed, that's what the Bills of Exchange Act says as well, and I brought it in source number 14. The expense of noting and protesting any bill and the postages thereby incurred shall be allowed and paid to the holder in addition to any interest thereon, and so on and so forth. There's more in the Bills of Exchange Act, but there the two sides agree. The last point is the briefest one, but has very serious ramifications. By the way, there's a whole objection by the work Kenyan Torah, which I quoted in source number 7, in which he tries to argue that you're not responsible. The writer is not responsible for the fee, but it's so long and drawn out, I wasn't going to bring it here. But the last point is this. If I buy an item by check, and the check bounces, is that grounds for the seller canceling the sale? What would you say?
I think that's two questions.
Okay.
One is if the seller hasn't delivered yet, and now the price of the property has gone up, he'd rather not deliver in the future. The other one is this a nullification of the contract retroactively?
So let's say the price hasn't changed. We'll stick with your second question. Does that nullify your agreement?
Yes.
Yeah.
We're hearing yes.
Yes.
So take a look at source number 15, please. Gemara says, Talmud says, Haiman dezaven midi lechavrei, a person sells something to somebody else, v'ka'ayo v'not v'kazuze. And the seller is coming and going for the money. He says to him, you know, would you pay me? And he's not getting paid. Lo kani, the item is not transferred. Meaning he can back out anytime he wants and say, you didn't pay me, therefore I'm going to take my item back and sell it to somebody else. But if he doesn't come and go for the money, he seems to be okay with the idea that it's going to take 30 days to get paid, then it's transferred. It's about what the seller's actions betray. However, Rabbi Yaakov Lorberbaum noted that it's not necessarily so. He says it depends on the way in which the buyer is not paying. He's commenting on source number 16. Source number 16 deals with the sale of a field. Rabbi Yosef Karo, in the Shulchan Aruch, in the Code of Jewish Law, deals with the following case. You sell a field to somebody for 1,000 zuz. Okay, how much is 1,000 zuz worth? Anybody know? You do. Tell me in goats.
Two zuz for goat.
Two zuz is a young goat, right? A goat in his first year. Chad Gadya, right? So it's 500 goats. So whatever goats, when I lived in Allentown, so we had somebody at the Daf Yomi Shir who went to investigate and found out that young goats were about $70-$75 at the county fair. And so we were able to make an estimate on what a zuz would be now. That doesn't tell us what goats cost back then. You know, when I was young, goats, you get a goat for it now. So the Shulchan Aruch says, if you sell a field to somebody else for... Ask Siri. Let's see what Siri says. Oddly enough. Okay. You sell a field to somebody for 1,000 zuz. And he pays part of the sum.
I'm sorry about this, but I can't take any requests
and the seller is asking for the rest, like described in source number 15. Even if he's only short one zuz, the purchaser has not acquired the entire field. And therefore, im chazer hamocher, if the seller then backs out, yad halokeach al ha'elyona, the buyer does have the upper hand. Meaning that the buyer can say, give me back my 999 zuz. Or he can say, give me 999 zuz worth of the land. For whatever I paid, I have acquired it. It's not as though the sale is all or nothing. But on that, Rabbi Lorberbaum, writing in source number 17, says that, and I'm going to say it in brief, because in the interest of time, but he says, it appears that the buyer can force the seller to fulfill the sale for whatever amount of money he has already paid, specifically where he says, I intend to pay you the rest of the money. And the seller is saying, well, I want the money now, and you're telling me you're going to give it to me tomorrow. But if the buyer doesn't actually have the money, I'll get it, but I don't actually have it, then the seller is able to cancel the entire sale. Because he only sells it with intent to be paid. He doesn't sell it with intent to have to wait for somebody to find money. Your intent as a merchant is to say, I want to be able to exchange this for money. Based on that, the Pesach Choshen says, bouncing a check is grounds for canceling the sale. The merchant is within his rights to say, unless it's something where you say, you can pay me in 30 days, you know, layaway or whatever it is, that's another story. But in the event that the seller says, pay me now, and you give him a check and the check bounces, the seller is indeed able to cancel the sale. Now, I wasn't able to find the relevant statute in Canada's laws, so I don't know what the law is within Canada, but that's what we're saying as Jewish law, and has a very important practical ramification. Let's say you want to buy a wedding ring. If you pay with a check, and the check bounces, you don't own the ring. And the man must own the ring. That's the question the rabbi's going to ask under the chuppah. He's going to ask you two questions, right? He's going to ask you, is this yours? He's going to ask you, how much is it worth? Or is it worth more than a pruta? But those two questions have to be answerable. And if you say, I own it, but you don't, then it's actually invalid. So you don't want to pay for a wedding ring with a check that might bounce. And the other application is lulav. The other application
We'll append that one to your wedding video. The other application is a lulav, because the rule is that you have to own your lulav. It has to be lachem. It has to be yours. And if you pay with a check and the check bounces, then you didn't own the lulav. So for that reason, people have to be very careful about paying for certain mitzvah items with a check. Thank you very much. I'm going to still stick around for people who want to discuss either that first question and what the meaning is of the Bills of Exchange Act or anything else. Our final session in this series is next week, and it's about dunning a debtor. What you can demand of a debtor, can you force him to go to work, and so on. And Jeff is holding up the sign there. On Monday the 23rd, I'll be giving a talk at Shari Shamayim. The topic is assisted suicide and the recent ruling of the Canada Supreme Court on the matter. Okay, thank you very much, and once again, thank you to Zeitman's for hosting and for providing lunch.